Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're digging into something really significant, potentially a game changer for India's tech future.
Absolutely. We're talking about this huge overhaul of the whole research system centered around the new Anusandhan National Research Foundation, or ANRF.
Right, the NRF. And specifically, we're zeroing in on its massive new financing arm, the Research Development and Innovation Scheme. Let's just call it the RDI fund, maybe.
Yeah, the RDI fund works. It's this big union cabinet-approved plan and the core idea to finally get the private sector seriously investing in high-tech R&D, not just leaving it all to government.
Okay, let's unpack that right away, because the problem it's trying to solve is pretty stark, isn't it? India's R&D spending has been stuck for ages, like around 0.6% of GDP.
Yeah, 0.64%, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, you look at advanced economies, they're often hitting 2%, sometimes way more, maybe even 5%. It's a huge gap.
So this RDI fund, it's not just throwing money at the problem. It's meant to be a fundamental shift, part of that whole Viksit Bharat 2047 vision, India aiming to be a developed nation by its 100th anniversary.
Exactly. And you can't really grasp the RDI fund without understanding the ANRF itself first. It came about through the 2023 Act, and importantly, it replaced the old SERB, the Science and Engineering Research Board.
Okay. SERB, what was the key difference there?
Well, SERB was mostly about, let's say, basic science funding, grants for fundamental research, pushing knowledge forward. ANRF is different. It's set up as the top body to give strategic direction. It's focused on research that has a mission that leads to economic results.
Ah, so moving from just funding research input to driving strategic market-focused output, that feels like the central theme here.
That's the philosophical shift, absolutely. Now, ANRF itself has a budget, about 50,000 crore rupees for the next 5 years or so for its broad mandate.
Uh-huh.
But this RDI scheme, the one we're focusing on, it sits kind of alongside it, or maybe on top. It's specifically for scaling up R&D in these critical sunrises sectors. And the number attached to it is just, staggering.
Yeah, let's get to that number. It really grabs your attention.
It does. The RDI scheme got the green light with a corpus of 1 lakh crore rupees.
1 lakh crore, that's what, over 12 billion U.S. dollars over 6 years?
Exactly. And the explicit goal is leveraging that to boost private sector R&D investment. In many developed countries, companies drive more than half the R&D spend. India is miles away from that. This fund is meant to bridge that gap big time.
So it's targeted money. Let's break down what it's actually trying to achieve. You mentioned 4 main aims.
Yes, 4 key objectives. First, pretty straightforward. Push the private sector to ramp up R&D in those strategic sunrise areas. Think economic security, self-reliance.
Makes sense. What's second?
Second is about financing projects that are already, further along the development path. Specifically, they're targeting TRL-4 and above, technology readiness level 4.
Okay, hold on there. TRL-4 and above, does that mean this isn't really about funding basic fundamental research anymore? Is it more like helping companies get products closer to market?
That's a really sharp point. TRL-4 means basically the core tech is validated in a lab environment. It's past the pure concept stage.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it does signal a strong focus on commercialization, on getting things out into the real world, not just ending up as papers.
So bridging that valley of death we always hear about between lab discovery and actual market success.
That seems to be a major part of the intent, yes. Getting innovations over that hump.
Okay, got it. So strategic, private R&D, TRL-4 plus projects.
Mm-hmm.
What are the other two aims?
The third one is quite direct, touches on that strategic autonomy idea. It's about helping acquire critical technologies from outside India if needed. Essentially, buying key tech.
Interesting. So make or buy.
Kind of, yeah. And fourth, setting up a special deep tech fund of funds. The goal there is to specifically support those advanced technology startups, the really cutting edge ones.
All right. Now the exciting bit. Which sectors are getting the special attention? Where is this 1 lakh crore likely to flow? It sounds like a wish list for the future economy.
It really does. The list is quite specific. You've got energy security and climate action, obviously huge areas. Then there's deep technology that includes things like quantum computing, robotics, advanced materials, space tech.
Really frontier stuff.
Absolutely. Then artificial intelligence, but specifically applied AI for sectors like agriculture, healthcare, education. Also, biotechnology and biomanufacturing, think pharma, new medical devices. And finally, the whole digital economy, which even includes things like digital agriculture.
Wow. Okay. That's a comprehensive list.
Yeah.
Now, with that much money and such critical sectors involved, the governance must be pretty high level, right? Who's actually steering this ship?
It's definitely centralized. Strategic direction comes from a governing board, and that's chaired by the Prime Minister.
Right at the top.
Then you have an executive council, the EC, which approves the nitty-gritty, the scheme guidelines and all that. And for checking progress and approving any big shifts, there's a powerful committee called the Empowered Group of Secretaries, the EGOs, which is headed by the Cabinet Secretary.
So PM sets the vision, but the top civil servants in the EGOs are really watching the performance closely.
That's how it looks. Yeah, they're the internal engine check. And the Department of Science and Technology, DST, is the department actually tasked with implementing the scheme on the ground.
Okay, let's switch gears to the money itself. The financial plumbing here is quite interesting. This two-tiered funding mechanism designed for patient capital. What does patient capital actually mean in this context, and why is it so important for, say, a deep tech startup?
It's absolutely critical. Patient capital means long-term funding, often with very low or even zero interest rates. Deep tech, you know, stuff like quantum or advanced biotech, it takes a long time to develop, and it's super risky, lots of failures.
Right. Traditional venture capital often wants a quicker return, doesn't it?
Exactly. VCs might look for an exit in, what, 5-7 years? Maybe sooner. Deep tech might need 10 years, 15 years, just to get to a viable product. Patient capital removes that short-term pressure. It basically says, okay, we understand this takes time, we're willing to wait. It significantly de-risks it for private investors who might come in alongside.
And tier one of this structure is where that patient capital originates.
Precisely. Tier one is this thing called the Special Purpose Fund, or SPF. Mm. It's set up within the ANRF, but operates as a separate business unit. It holds the 1 lakh crore. And here's the kicker, the really crucial part.
Okay.
The government provides this entire 1 lakh crore to the ANRS, to this SPF, as a 50-year interest-free loan.
50 years, interest-free.
50 years, zero interest. That gives the fund incredible stability and a very, very long planning horizon. It's genuinely patient money from the government side.
Okay, so the SPF is like the central bank holding the reserves. Mm. Who are the ones actually dealing with companies and projects lending the money out?
That's tier two. They're called second-level fund managers, or SLFMs. The main SPF fund allocates capital to these SLFMs, and they're the ones who do the direct financing of the R&D projects.
And who are these SLFMs? Are they government bodies, too?
This is another interesting bit. No, not necessarily. The scheme explicitly allows various types of entities to be SLFMs. We're talking alternative investment funds, AIFs, like private equity or venture funds, development finance institutions, DFIs, non-banking financial companies, NBFCs, and even focused research organizations, FROs.
So they're deliberately using market-based financial entities to deploy public money, trying to get some private sector efficiency in there.
That seems to be the logic, yes. Get entities that are used to evaluating deals and managing investments to handle the allocation rather than just a government committee. Impose some market discipline, as you said earlier.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, what about the companies actually getting the money, the eligible technology entities? Are there strict rules for them?
Oh, yes. Very clear rules, mainly designed to make sure the company has its own skin in the game. The RDI funding from these SLFMs can cover no more than 50% of the total assessed cost of the R&D project.
Only up to half.
Max half. The company has to find the other 50% or more itself, either through commercial loans, other investors, or its own cash.
So no free rides?
Definitely not. And the funding itself usually comes as a long-term loan on easy concessional terms, or sometimes as equity, especially if it's a startup. And don't forget, the project has to be R&D intensive, high uncertainty, based on real science or engineering, and at that TRL4 or higher level we talked about.
Right. Now let's get into something you touched on earlier, this idea of national control, strategic autonomy. If public money is flowing into these critical areas, there must be some strings attached regarding ownership and control, right?
Absolutely. This isn't just about funding innovation. It's about ensuring India benefits strategically. There are some pretty strict requirements.
Such as?
Well, the company receiving the funds has to be registered in India. Its global headquarters must be in India. And here's a big one. The company must be under the control of resident Indian citizens.
Hold on. Control by resident Indian citizens? That sounds significant. Does that mean foreign investors or even non-resident Indians can invest but can't have controlling stakes in these strategically funded companies?
That seems to be the implication, yes. Control must rest with resident Indian citizens. It's a strong measure.
Okay, that immediately raises a huge question, doesn't it? Is this a necessary safeguard to keep critical technology and IP within India, or could it actually hinder growth by potentially scaring off the very global investment and expertise these companies might need to scale up and compete internationally?
That is the central tension, I think. It's a direct trade-off. On one hand, you ensure strategic control. The rules also state that any intellectual property, any IPR, generated from this RDI funding must be registered in India and owned in India for its entire term. So the tech stays domestic.
Which supports the strategic autonomy goal.
Precisely. But on the other hand, yes, you might limit access to global capital pools or partnerships if foreign entities feel they can't have a controlling interest. It's a protectionist approach designed to build domestic capability and prevent critical tech leaking out, but it might come at the cost of slower scaling or less access to international markets and know-how.
It's a bold choice. Okay, so we have this massive fund, this intricate structure, these strategic goals, and these national control mechanisms, but setting up the structure is one thing. Making it work effectively in the real world, especially in India's complex R&D environment, that's another challenge altogether, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The framework looks impressive on paper, but the ANRF and the RDI Fund face some serious headwinds, some deep-rooted problems that already exist in the Indian R&D ecosystem. This is where we need to talk about the potential pitfalls, the structural concerns.
Right. What's the first major hurdle you see?
Well, interestingly, it starts right at the top with the leadership composition. Some analysis points to a significant representation gap on both the main governing board and the executive council.
A representation gap? How so?
Think about it. The ANRF is supposed to boost research across all universities, right? But apparently, something like 95% of India's students are in state universities. Yet, the initial setup seems to have no members from either central or state universities on these key decision-making boards.
No university representation on the boards deciding research funding strategy for universities. That sounds problematic.
It raises questions, definitely. If the people making the decisions don't have direct ground-level experience of the bottlenecks and challenges within the bulk of the university system, how effectively can they target funding or design policies to fix those issues?
It could lead to a disconnect, couldn't it, between the top-level strategy and the realities on the ground for most researchers and students?
That's the concern. And it's not just universities. There are also questions about whether domestic industry is adequately represented. And gender diversity seems limited, too, with maybe only one woman initially mentioned on the key bodies. So you have this potentially very centralized, top-heavy structure. Can it really understand and tackle the diverse grassroots problems across academia and industry? It's a big ask.
Okay, so governance structure concerns are one thing. What about the existing R&D environment itself? You mentioned a triple threat of challenges.
Yes, beyond the ANRF's own structure, it inherits some major systemic problems. The first threat is fundamental.
Yeah.
It's about research integrity.
You mean fraud?
Unfortunately, yes. India's scientific community has been facing some serious issues with research credibility. There's been a reported sharp increase in journal paper retractions, like maybe 2.5 times higher in recent years compared to just before. Often linked to things like paper mills, selling fake research, plagiarism, data manipulation.
Wow, that's deeply concerning. If the basic research itself is sometimes unreliable, then building high-tech industries on top of it becomes really risky.
Exactly. It's a foundational crisis of credibility. For the ANRF to succeed, and for India's R&D to gain global respect, it needs incredibly robust systems. We're talking strict audits, clear ethical guidelines, transparent processes, and real consequences for misconduct. You can't build world-class tech on shaky research foundations. Patient capital won't help if the underlying science is flawed.
Okay, so research integrity is threat number one. What's the second major systemic hurdle?
This ties back directly to that TRL4 focus we discussed. It's the problem of scale-up failure. India is often quite good at the part of R&D, the research in the lab. Where we often stumble is the development and actually getting those innovations successfully scaled up into commercially viable, globally competitive products, especially through the private sector.
The valley of death again. We discover things but struggle to turn them into businesses.
That's a persistent issue. Even look at many of our established public research labs. Their track record of spinning out successful large-scale commercial ventures isn't always that strong. So the ANRF can't just fund projects to TRL 4 or 5. It needs to actively nurture them beyond that. It needs mechanisms for stress testing prototypes, for connecting researchers with manufacturers, marketers, and users. It needs to foster that entire ecosystem coordination to get things from the lab bench all the way to the global market. Otherwise, the innovations will just wither.
Makes sense. You need the whole chain, not just the first link. All right. And the third threat in this triple threat.
The third one is about funding rigidity and institutional bureaucracy. Historically, government funding systems, like some under the DST, have had rules that sometimes make it difficult for private companies or research outfits to get funding directly. Often, they've had to partner with a public university or institute, adding layers of complexity and slowing things down.
So the system itself could be a bottleneck.
It can be, yeah. If the ANRF wants to genuinely attract and energize private R&D, it needs to be perceived as flexible, agile, and outcome-focused, not just another government department tangled in red tape. It needs to be easy to work with, prioritize the quality of the research idea over the type of institution proposing it, and make decisions relatively quickly. That's often not the traditional way public funds are disbursed, so it requires a real cultural shift within the funding body itself.
Okay, let's try to pull all this together for you, the listener. What we have here is, on one hand, this truly massive financial commitment that EuroLAC CROR RDI Fund. It's designed with innovative features like patient capital, delivered through market-oriented fund managers like AIFs, all aimed squarely at pulling private money into critical high-tech R&D sectors.
That's the promise, yes. The ANRF is meant to be a complete reboot, replacing the old SERB model. It's tasked with driving systemic change, finally bridging that gap between university research and industry application, and really catalyzing private innovation.
But on the other hand, its success isn't guaranteed just by the money. It depends heavily on whether it can fix those initial governance issues, the representation gaps, the diversity concerns, and perhaps even more critically, whether it can overcome those long-standing, deep systemic problems in the Indian R&D landscape.
Right. Tackling research fraud, overcoming the scale-up failures, and avoiding bureaucratic rigidity, those are huge challenges. And remember, deep tech is inherently risky. Failure rates for startups in this space are incredibly high, maybe 90-95% fail between the early seed stage and getting significant follow-on funding.
So the real test for the ANRF and the RDI fund won't just be about how much of that 1 lakh crore gets spent over the next 6 years.
No, not at all. The true measure of success will be tangible results.
Yeah.
Will we see a sustained, significant rise in India's overall R&D spending as a percentage of GDP? Will Indian companies become genuinely more competitive on the global stage in these strategic technologies? Will it demonstrably boost India's technological self-reliance?
The stated goal is ambitious, isn't it? To rank among the top handful of nations globally in key technologies, enabling that Viksit Bharat vision.
That's the aspiration.
It's a high bar. Which circles us back to that final, really provocative point we discussed earlier. That strict requirement for strategic autonomy, demanding that the IP stays in India, and crucially, that control of the funded companies rests with resident Indian citizens.
Yes, that fundamental choice.
So we leave you with this thought. Will this strong protectionist mandate succeed in its goal? Will it accelerate India's journey to technological sovereignty by ensuring critical innovations and their control remain domestic? Or could that very requirement, the insistence on resident Indian control, inadvertently limit the access to the global capital, the international partnerships, and the scale needed to truly compete head-to-head with the world's biggest innovation powerhouses? It's a massive experiment, and the stakes are incredibly high.